The following audiobook contains AI-generated content and may contain errors. MyAudiobooks.ai presents Pit Lane and Pavement, Indianapolis, Mobility, Heat, and the Design of Risk. Topic Introduction. On a hot afternoon in Indianapolis, the pit lane of the motor speedway can feel almost serene, as if danger has been carefully persuaded to stay behind the wall. A car rolls forward with its engine humming low and urgent. The crew steps back on instinct, and the concrete barriers hold the promise that speed will remain contained here, inside a system built to absorb the stakes. Beyond the fence, the city looks ordinary. A road, a stoplight, a sidewalk, a bus stop, a patch of grass with too little shade. Yet that contrast is the beginning of the story, because the same region that knows how to engineer risk on a racetrack keeps struggling to manage it everywhere else. Central Indiana sits at the center of that contradiction. In one direction, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway turns motion into spectacle and control into identity. In another, ordinary streets carry pedestrians, cyclists, transit riders, and drivers through a landscape shaped for cars first and people second. The difference matters. On the track, speed is allowed because it is measured, bounded, and monitored. In the city, speed often becomes a burden that falls hardest on those who never chose it. That tension gives this audiobook its pulse. How a place built around automobiles decides who gets protection, who gets convenience, and who absorbs the risk when the system fails. The questions reach far beyond racing, even though racing is where they begin. In the spring of 2026, the announcement of a Freedom 250 Grand Prix around Washington, District of Columbia, linked civic language and car culture with unusual directness. A race presented as a celebration of freedom asks a deceptively simple question: freedom for whom and at whose expense? The answer does not live only in the language of marketing or in the drama of a starting grid. It lives in the design of the roads, the rules of the pit lane, the medical teams on standby, and the fact that a closed course can contain danger in a way that public streets cannot. That distinction will recur throughout the audiobook. A closed course is a place where engineers, officials, and drivers accept the premise that danger must be ringed by barriers, harnesses, trained personnel, and strict limits. A public street is different. It is shared by people with uneven power and uneven options. A parent pushing a stroller, a worker waiting for a bus, a cyclist threading through traffic, an older adult crossing a wide arterial road, a person who can afford a private vehicle and a person who cannot. In that shared space, risk is not simply managed. It is distributed. The same pattern appears in the city's climate landscape. When people talk about tree canopy, they mean the living cover formed by the crowns of trees above streets, parks, and yards. It sounds like a pleasant phrase, almost decorative. In practice, canopy is infrastructure. It cools sidewalks, softens stormwater, and makes a summer trip on foot feel possible instead of punishing. The idea of tree equity, another term that will matter here, is equally plain and unsettling. It means asking which neighborhoods have enough trees and which neighborhoods have been left to absorb heat without them. In central Indiana, that question opens onto maps of vulnerability, maintenance, development history, and public investment. That is why parks, sidewalks, and bus stops belong in the same conversation as racetracks and roads. A park renovation can either widen access or quietly narrow it, depending on where entrances are placed, how maintenance is funded, and whether shade is treated as essential or optional. A bus stop without canopy can become a place of exposure rather than a place of passage. A street without trees can turn a short walk into a test of endurance. Even the best-intentioned civic projects can miss their mark if they are designed without attention to who will actually use them at the hottest, hardest moments of the day. Then there is the digital layer, which makes the story feel even more contemporary and even less controllable. Modern vehicles no longer rely only on steel, glass, and human reflexes. Some carry driver assistance systems, including a Level 2 advanced driver assistance system, which means software can help steer and regulate speed while still depending on the driver to remain alert and ready to take over. That sounds straightforward until the boundary between assistance and responsibility begins to blur. When the car appears to be helping, how attentive does the human remain? When a flaw exists in code rather than in metal, how quickly can the danger be identified, corrected, and communicated across an entire fleet through a wireless software update? These are not separate stories. They are one story told to two different surfaces. A racetrack makes it easy to see the logic of safety because the whole place is designed around control. A city makes that logic harder because control is incomplete and everyone shares the consequences. Street design, transit access, tree canopy, park maintenance, and vehicle software all shape the same basic civic question: what kind of risk is acceptable, and who gets asked to carry it? That is the invitation of this audiobook. It begins with speed, but it does not stay there. It moves outward into shade, software, public space, and the everyday politics of mobility. Along the way, it asks listeners to notice what is usually invisible: how a sidewalk becomes either shelter or exposure, how a neighborhood becomes either resilient or vulnerable, how a vehicle becomes either a convenience or a hazard, and how a city quietly reveals its values in the places where it builds, delays, repairs, or neglects. By the end, the familiar landscape of central Indiana will look less ordinary. The pit lane, the bus stop, the park bench, the treeless block, the software update, and the widened road will all begin to read as parts of the same civic design. And once that design comes into view, the harder question remains: if a city can build extraordinary systems to protect speed, why is it so much harder to build everyday systems that protect people? End of introduction. The pit lane of a processional racetrack feels like a world built to keep danger from spreading. Vehicles enter on schedules, personnel move with practiced routines, thick concrete and reinforced walls stand between speed and the public, while the course itself is lined with impact-absorbing barriers designed to take a blow instead of letting it travel outward. Inside the cockpit, drivers sit in survival cells and are restrained by multi-point harnesses. The goal is not to eliminate risk, but to cage it inside a tightly controlled system where equipment, rules, and trained response are meant to manage what happens when things go wrong. Central Indiana's best-known racing facility, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and the IndyCar series it hosts, have turned that engineered control into identity. The spectacle is motion, but it is also a public argument about how society handles danger when it treats safety as a design problem. Speed is allowed, in other words, because it is measured, constrained, and governed. Even pace has boundaries, with electronic speed limits and penalties intended to keep vehicles operating within the pit lane's rules. Sometimes, that controlled version of motion spills outward and becomes a national symbol about what freedom looks like when it is tied to cars. On May 15, 2026, event organizers announced the Freedom 250 Grand Prix of Washington, District of Columbia, scheduled for August 22 through 23, 2026. It is billed as the first IndyCar race routed around the National Mall and surrounding city streets. Organizers said fans can request limited free general admission tickets through an online Ticketmaster portal between May 29th and June 7th, with allocation handled through random drawing and a cap of 4 free tickets per day, per fan. The branding links civic liberty to a particular kind of public motion, speed made visible through a car-centric spectacle in the symbolic center of American democracy. That symbol has a hidden engineering premise. Racing safety depends on a closed-course logic ordinary streets cannot replicate. Tracks are ordered environments, supported by layered rules, controlled access, specialized vehicle designs, and medical response positioned close to the action. Safety features are built to work together, not as separate add-ons. Head and neck restraints, reinforced fuel cells, and deformable steel barriers form a broader chain of protection. It also includes licensing, training, and the simple fact that the public is kept outside the line of fire. In that loop, risk is reduced by removing unpredictability and keeping danger from spilling into everyday life. Outside the speedway gates, the road network in central Indiana creates a different equation. High-speed risk is not contained to trained participants in protective gear. It is borne by people who share the edges of traffic and cannot opt out when danger arrives, including pedestrians crossing wide avenues, cyclists navigating painted lanes, transit riders waiting near fast-moving lanes, and commuters traveling long distances because daily routes are built around private vehicles. Everyday road risk behaves less like a chosen challenge and more like a structural hazard imposed by how places are connected and by who gets protected when something goes wrong. This is why automobile dependence sits at the center of mobility politics, climate policy, and public safety across central Indiana. The region's built form drew around an assumption that most trips would be made by car. Suburban sprawl and the distances between common destinations turn the private vehicle into a default requirement for routine movement. Once that becomes the norm, alternatives do not simply lag behind. They operate under constraints created by geography, land use, and road design. Transit may exist, but it often runs through a system shaped more by vehicle routes and storage than by easy pedestrian access or frequent, reliable mode choices. Indigo ridership statistics for January through April in both 2024 and 2025 show transit's ongoing importance alongside its limits. In January 2024, Indigo reported 506,512 boardings, compared with 503,182 in January 2025. In February 2024, boardings were 550,034, then dropped to 508,304 in February 2025. April showed a similar pattern, with more than 587,000 boardings in April 2024, decreasing to 582,502 in April 2025. Those numbers do not describe transit as marginal. They reflect a large recurring set of trips made by people who rely on mass transit. At the same time, the broader implication matches the region's long-standing pattern of automobile dependence, with much of metropolitan movement still happening by car, and with the practical switching barriers that come from streets and land use built for vehicles first. In regional transportation planning, the same constraints appear in how unmet needs for seniors, people with disabilities, and low-income residents are identified, then mapped against what providers can realistically serve and where gaps persist. The climate planning shift in central Indiana puts these mobility questions into sharper focus. The Central Indiana Priority Climate Action Plan, released in 2024 through the Central Indiana Regional Development Authority, with federal support connected to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Climate Pollution Reduction Grants Program, frames transportation as a connected source of greenhouse gas emissions and as a driver of unequal access to safe movement. The plan treats mode shift and equity as linked, not separate projects. At the county scale, Monroe County's Climate Resilience Plan, adopted in December 2024, takes the same logic and translates it into infrastructure stress. It identifies major highways and routes as critical corridors under climate strain, naming Interstate 69 and State Roads 37, 45, 46, and 48 as especially vulnerable to extreme heat, flooding, and other severe weather impacts. Because those corridors connect major population and employment areas, disruptions can ripple outward, affecting mobility, emergency response, and the ability of communities to reach basic services when the system is already uneven. This is where the freedom story collides with what private car dependence costs people in lived experience. Owning and driving promise independence, but for many families, that promise becomes an obligation paid for in money, in exposure to traffic danger, and in the isolation that comes from being able to move only in one mode. In late December of 2024, an analysis of a survey of 2,155 adults in the United States reported that people who took more than one half of their trips by private car reported lower overall life satisfaction than those who relied less on automobiles. The same analysis found that drivers traveling more than 200 miles per week reported even lower life satisfaction, and that the pattern persisted after controlling for household income, race, and gender. That result is not a blanket claim that every driver is unhappy or that cars never improve daily life. It is a signal that beyond a threshold, dependence can turn routine movement into a drain rather than a choice. Even with those costs in view, street design standards and land use patterns in the region continue to prioritize vehicle throughput. Wide lanes, sparse crossings, and sprawling commercial layouts push everyday travel toward the logic of speed and capacity rather than toward safety for people walking, biking, waiting, or transferring. In that setup, ordinary movement becomes harder for those outside cars, and streets can begin to function like barriers. The danger is not only physical, it is practical too, because when walking routes are discontinuous and crossings appear where traffic meets them least, the street becomes a place people must survive instead of a place they can comfortably use. Speed limits, crosswalk placement, sidewalk width, bus frequency, and where transit stops land along routes are not neutral inputs. They operate as civic instruments that determine which kinds of risk show up in public records and which remain invisible until an injury makes them undeniable. When local streets are designed without safe crossings or with sidewalks that end where a person needs to go next, pedestrian injuries and fatalities stop looking like isolated accidents. They become predictable outcomes of how space is allocated. Funding battles deepen those patterns. Across central Indiana, local governments face competing priorities, including highway widening and pavement repair, alongside investment in sidewalks, transit expansion, and climate-resilient infrastructure. When budgets lean toward vehicle capacity and maintenance aimed at cars, transit agencies can end up underfunded relative to the needs identified in planning documents, and pedestrian safety improvements can wait. Over time, that delay can lock in the same dependency that created the demand in the first place. The opening comparison returns to a question that sounds simple and stays difficult. When freedom is measured mainly by the speed of vehicles, who receives mobility and who receives exposure? The pit lane shows that speed can be paired with layered protections, training, barriers, and rapid medical response. On public streets, speed continues to be treated as acceptable risk, and the burden often falls on people with the fewest options to separate themselves from traffic. In that mismatch, the design of shared space becomes a moral and political choice expressed in plain engineering terms. Shade, heat, and stormwater are the next infrastructure systems on the table, because trees affect who can stay outside safely and whose neighborhoods absorb the climate pressures we manage or ignore. A 2025 peer-reviewed synthesis on urban tree cooling, along with Indianapolis canopy assessment and city planning documents from 2024 through 2026, underpin the cooling ranges, canopy threshold, and local tree gap figures used in this argument. The roadway is where danger is easiest to see. In a crash, speed becomes force, and the city's job is to separate bodies from that force with barriers, lines, signals, and rules. But there is another kind of exposure that works without impact. In central Indiana, a summer afternoon can turn heat into a daily condition that slows people down, narrows where they can safely go, and raises the cost of every wait outside. On a hot day, the difference between outside and unusable outside often comes down to something older than policy and simpler than technology. Tree canopy changes what people experience at walking speed. It can shade sidewalks so a trip to a store does not feel like a test of endurance. It can cool the edges of parks where families gather, and it can cover transit stops where riders are stationary for long stretches of time. When canopy is missing, heat stops being an abstract weather event and becomes a barrier to mobility, recreation, and basic rest. That shift sits at the center of this part of the story. From safety as the prevention of collisions, to safety as the management of thermal risk. The infrastructure is not a new kind of road. It is the living system that shades public life. And unlike a curb or a barrier, trees stay useful only if they are planned, maintained, and replaced. Urban and peri-urban forestry is often imagined as planting. In practice, it behaves more like an ongoing utility service. To build a canopy that lasts, planners start with species selection and site conditions, then return to the same places year after year. Young trees need water, and pruning has to support long-term structure rather than short-term appearance. Cities also manage invasive pests and aggressive growth, so canopy does not become a problem in disguise. Storm resilience is part of the job as well. Mature branches can fail if species, placement, and maintenance do not account for wind, ice, and wet weather. Because trees eventually die, canopy planning has to include replacement cycles, so shade does not disappear all at once in a neighborhood that already has little margin for heat. When a city treats trees as civic infrastructure, the planning math changes. A mature canopy can intercept rainfall before it reaches the ground in full force. Leaves and branches break up precipitation and slow the movement of water over streets and lawns, reducing the share that turns into stormwater runoff. Trees also cool the air and surfaces through biology, not just through the presence of shade. In that sense, canopy is both a heat measure and a water measure. It can also shape how people use transit and parks, because comfort influences whether movement happens in the open or gets postponed indoors. Cooling follows two linked pathways. Shade works because leaves and branches block solar radiation from reaching the pavement and walls below. People do not experience only surfaces, though. They move through air, and air temperature cooling depends on evapotranspiration. Roots draw water from soil and transport it upward, and leaves release that water vapor through pores. When that process runs well, it pulls heat out of the local environment and helps reduce temperatures beyond what a small patch of shade can do on its own. How strong the cooling is depends on canopy structure, not just tree count. Leaf area and canopy density matter, as does whether vegetation is layered, with shrubs and ground cover contributing to the overall system. A useful distinction also gets lost in casual discussions. Surface cooling can feel immediate and localized. Air temperature cooling tends to require enough foliage over a broader area so that warm air passes through the canopy's cooling zone. Across studies reviewed from 2018 through 2024 and published in 2025, urban tree-covered areas reliably reduced ambient air temperatures, with typical reductions in the range of about 0.8 to 1.6 degrees Celsius. The point is not that trees erase heat. It is that canopy can change the intensity of the heat load in everyday life, including during the hottest hours when risk peaks. The cooling does not show up evenly across neighborhoods. The same review ascribed a canopy threshold pattern, where more pronounced air temperature reductions tend to appear once local tree cover reaches roughly 35 to 50%. Below that range, isolated shade can help at a specific spot, but it struggles to lower neighborhood air temperature in a sustained way. Above it, canopy's collective effect can create a more protective microclimate. That threshold is not automatic. It depends on species mix and water availability, since drought-stressed trees can close leaf pores and reduce transpiration when cooling is most needed. That is why the conversation moves from how many trees do we have to where are the missing trees and who experiences the consequences. Planners cannot rely on citywide averages because heat is not evenly distributed and vulnerability is not evenly distributed either. In 2024, a canopy need tool upgrade helped sharpen that targeting by combining neighborhood information on income, age, existing tree cover, and surface temperature. The practical result is a map of where high heat overlaps with people who have more exposure and fewer ways to escape it. When that framework is applied to Indianapolis, it points to the scale of the gap. A public analysis using updated metrics found that bringing neighborhoods up to an ideal tree equity benchmark would require on the order of 3.3 million additional trees. The magnitude reflects more than missing foliage. It mirrors long-standing patterns in where development happened, how infrastructure got funded, and where canopy improvements received attention over decades. At the neighborhood level, the disparity can feel like ordinary geography. The mere south side is one example of a low canopy area, with canopy coverage around 14%. With so little existing shade, residents can experience higher surface temperatures in summer. The same canopy shortfall can also affect how water behaves during storms, since less canopy and vegetation cover can mean more runoff that is not intercepted before it reaches streets. In a place like this, The environment charges daily attention. Heat where people walk, unmanaged runoff where water pools, and a reduced buffer against extreme days. Because the costs show up in daily movement, tree planting priorities often end up combining exposure and vulnerability. If older residents are more likely to be harmed by heat, and if lower-income households may rely more heavily on the public realm for comfort because they have fewer private options to retreat, then canopy investments are not only environmental, they also reduce barriers that already shape mobility. That can mean focusing on routes people actually use, sidewalks for walking and school-age movement, bus stops where riders wait in direct sun, and street crossings where shaded and unstretched conditions determine whether an errand feels manageable or dangerous. Those priorities can collide with another necessity: stewardship of the existing tree stock itself. Washington Park on the east side of Indianapolis illustrates the trade-off that comes when canopy includes invasive species. In 2026, the city's Department of Public Works plans to remove 70 invasive trees from the park and replace them with native species, with the goal of restoring the urban forest to function better in the local ecosystem. Restoration can still create an immediate cooling loss. Removing 70 mature trees does not come with a same-day substitute canopy, even if new saplings are installed. Mature trees provide shade and stormwater interception now, while young trees need years before they can match those functions. For park users who rely on shade through the hottest hours, the benefit of a healthier forest later can feel distant. In the short term, the project can shift heat burden onto the same people who already have fewer alternatives. That is where equity becomes more than a slogan. Native species restoration is a public good, but it can impose uneven near-term costs, especially in neighborhoods that already have limited canopy. The planning challenge is to balance long-term ecological goals with immediate human needs. That can involve phasing work, coordinating timing with seasonal heat patterns, and pairing removals with temporary mitigation strategies when feasible. Even when decisions are made for legitimate stewardship reasons, the timing of shade loss matters. Long-term benefits depend on maintenance as well. Planting is the first step, not the finish line. Young trees need watering during their establishment period, and pruning has to support safe structure over time. Cities also have to manage storm debris and conflicts between roots and pavement, because infrastructure can damage trees even as trees support infrastructure. When maintenance funding is stretched thin, newly planted trees can die at higher rates, leaving empty grates and broken surfaces where shade was promised. In that sense, maintenance is equity in another form, because it determines whether canopy investments survive long enough for residents to receive the protection they were designed to deliver. Once shade is treated this way, it stops being an ornament and starts functioning like mobility infrastructure. A sidewalk without shade in July can become physically exhausting. For some residents, it becomes effectively impassable. A bus stop without canopy can turn waiting into a health risk, particularly when transit schedules do not offer control over how long someone stands in the sun. Park edges can act as shelter or as exposure, depending on whether canopy exists where people linger. Shaded sidewalks, shaded transit stops, and shaded gathering areas connect daily life to destinations. When that connection weakens, the city's movement system becomes less reliable, not only because routes are longer, but because conditions make movement harder. Those same choices about comfort and access show up in public space design, including the ongoing renovation of Chapel Hill Park. The renovation functions as a portal into how the city weighs competing municipal needs. Decisions about entrances, paths, lighting, seating, play areas, and access points shape how people actually experience the park. Who can approach it safely? Who can stay in it comfortably? And which users find it welcoming during the hottest hours? But design decisions do not sit above budgets. They are shaped by tension between capital budgets that fund construction and operating budgets that pay for maintenance afterward. Deferred maintenance is common in public systems, and it can leave parks with broken benches, overgrown walkways, and lighting that fails when it matters most. During a renovation, officials face a practical question. If the city builds new features, can it also keep them clean, safe, and functional through the years that follow? Public participation is supposed to help answer that question, but it can also tilt outcomes toward people who are easiest to reach. Workshops held during working hours, online surveys that assume stable internet access, and outreach that does not match residents' schedules can elevate some needs while leaving others underrepresented. In a park, that can show up as amenities that serve the most visible user groups, while the needs of shift workers, transit riders, and low-income families who rely on the park to rest in shade receive less design emphasis. Even the physical layout can become participation infrastructure. A bench placed where afternoon sun dominates can be functionally unreachable. An exposed plaza can make a public gathering space feel like a private exclusion for those who do not have air-conditioned alternatives. A play area without canopy coverage can turn family use into a seasonal gamble. When people cannot comfortably use a park during peak heat, the design can exclude in practice, even if it still looks open on a map. Providing shade, then, is not only environmental. It is about whether public space actually serves the public. At the same time, not every uneven outcome comes from bad intent. Invasive removal, project phasing, and delayed amenities can reflect legitimate stewardship and engineering decisions made under resource constraints. The point is that constraints still distribute outcomes. Removing invasive trees can protect an ecosystem, even as it temporarily reduces shade. Delaying a playground can manage risk within a limited budget, while postponing benefits that some families need sooner. The city's governance choices can be rational and still uneven in who bears the near-term burdens. All of it adds up to a broadened definition of safety. Safety is not only about preventing crashes and structural failures. It is also about heat, stormwater, shade, maintenance, and the design of the spaces where people wait, walk, and gather. In a warming world, long-term stewardship becomes part of everyday mobility, because the conditions around a trip shape whether movement is safe and whether public life stays possible. The same responsibility that governs shade and park use also reaches the digital layer of transportation, where code, oversight, and system limits determine what happens when automated features do not perform as promised. The modern city does not end where the physical infrastructure of asphalt, curb, and canopy stops. It continues upward into an invisible layer of digital code running on silicon boards inside our vehicles. When we examine safety on our roads, we see a shift from physical barriers and concrete medians to software programs that monitor driver attention and control steering. This digital shift changes how we allocate public risk, turning what was once a series of mechanical problems into an ongoing debate over software design, corporate responsibility, and regulatory oversight. Federal safety recall records from 2023, filed with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, document a critical case study in this new era of technological governance. The filings analyze how driver assistance features operate under real-world conditions, rather than focusing on a classic physical defect like a fractured axle or a leaking brake line. The safety agency made clear that the risk of collision shifts from a question of mechanical failure to a product of how human drivers interact with automated features. But the center of this federal investigation was AutoSteer, a feature classified under the Society of Automotive Engineers standards as a Level 2 Advanced Driver Assistance System. Systems at this level assist with lane centering and speed control under specific conditions, but they are not fully autonomous. They require continuous active human monitoring. The driver must remain engaged with hands on the wheel, ready to take control at any moment, because the system cannot navigate all traffic variables on its own. The scale of this safety recall demonstrates how deeply automated systems are integrated into our transportation networks. Federal documents show that the estimated scope of the recall encompassed 2,031,220 vehicles. This represents a massive share of the manufacturer's vehicles operating on public roads. It shows that software-based risks are not isolated occurrences, by fleet-wide conditions affecting millions of drivers simultaneously. The recall records noted that 100% of these potentially involved vehicles were believed to contain the safety defect. In traditional manufacturing, a physical defect might occur in a single run of weak steel or a loose bolt on an assembly line, affecting only a small fraction of cars. With software, however, the issue is embedded in the digital architecture itself. Because every vehicle runs the exact same computer code, the potential hazard was universal, instantly scaling risk across the entire national fleet. The safety concern identified by federal regulators was not a hardware failure, but the danger of human misuse. The investigation concluded that an increased collision risk exists when drivers misuse AutoSteer, fail to maintain continuous attention, or misunderstand system limits. When software handles routine steering and pacing, human operators experience a decline in situational awareness. This cognitive gap can lead to delayed responses in critical moments, showing how an assistive system can create new hazards by inviting driver disengagement. The remedy for this widespread safety risk did not require owners to visit dealerships or wait for mechanical parts. Instead, the manufacturer deployed a no-cost, over-the-air software update beginning December 12, 2023. This digital correction changed vehicle safety maintenance, showing that a hazard across millions of active vehicles could be addressed through a wireless transmission of new code while cars sat parked in driveways. This update introduced more restrictive digital boundaries designed to manage driver behavior. The new code added prominent visual alerts, more frequent audio warnings, and stricter controls to encourage drivers to keep their hands on the wheel and pay attention when the system is active. If a driver fails to respond to these cues, the system issues escalating warnings and can even suspend access to the feature, using digital design to enforce human responsibility. Production vehicles built from midday on December 7, 2023 onward received the updated software directly at the factory before delivery. Formal letters were scheduled to go out to existing owners by February 10, 2024. This rapid sequence shows how digital governance operates, allowing safety patches to be implemented across millions of vehicles in weeks, rather than the months or years required to distribute physical parts. This shift marks a move from traditional mechanical recalls to dynamic software governance. Safety remedies now arrive as digital updates after vehicles are already in public use, traveling next to pedestrians and cyclists on daily commutes. This turns vehicle safety from a static engineering standard met at the factory into an ongoing real-time loop where public roads serve as the active testing ground for continuous digital refinement. As these systems populate our roads, they also reshape the legal landscape, turning driver assistance litigation into disputes over liability and product design. Modern lawsuits are no longer simple battles over broken physical components. Instead, they focus on user interface design, the adequacy of driver monitoring systems, and whether a manufacturer is responsible for foreseeable human misuse. Courts must decide how much warning is necessary to keep a driver engaged, and where the boundary lies between individual driver error and corporate design responsibility. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration oversees these vehicle safety recalls and evaluates defect remedies. As the federal regulator of automobile safety, the agency is tasked with evaluating both the mechanical soundness of cars and the cognitive impacts of digital systems. This responsibility requires authorities to develop new methods of evaluation, testing how software interfaces affect driver attention, and how quickly manufacturers must act when a digital hazard is identified. This public environment stands in sharp contrast to the closed, highly engineered safety systems of professional motorsport. On a racetrack, every element is part of an integrated, monitored network. Drivers are trained professionals, vehicles are built around protective survival cells, and emergency teams are positioned seconds away. On our public streets, safety is not contained. It is distributed among manufacturers, software engineering teams, drivers with varying skills, municipal planners, regulatory agencies, and civil courts, all operating without a closed course. This contrast highlights a fundamental question: who defines acceptable levels of technological risk on public roads? When semi-automated vehicles are deployed on shared streets, everyone who walks, bikes, or waits for a bus is exposed to potential failures without consenting to participate in a trial. Regulating these systems is more than a technical challenge for software developers. It is a civic decision about how we balance public safety against private convenience. While we grapple with the digital safety of vehicles, international regulatory shifts are also addressing their environmental impacts. According to European Union regulatory records from 2023, the governing body has established strict carbon dioxide emission standards for passenger vehicles. The regulations aim for a 100% fleet-wide tailpipe carbon dioxide reduction for all new cars and vans, starting in 2035. This rule effectively phases out the sale of new internal combustion engine vehicles, prompting the global automotive industry to pivot towards zero-emission technologies. To guide manufacturers toward this transition, the European Union established interim targets. For the period spanning 2025 through 2029, manufacturers must limit their average fleet emissions to 93.6 grams of carbon dioxide per kilometer for passenger cars. For light commercial vans, the limit is 153.9 grams of carbon dioxide per kilometer. These targets require immediate increases in the production and sale of electric and hybrid models, forcing automakers to adjust their fleets in real time. The regulatory pressure increases in the following compliance window, from 2030 through 2034. During this phase, average emissions targets drop to 49.5 grams of carbon dioxide per kilometer for passenger cars. For commercial vans, the target becomes 90.6 grams per kilometer. The reductions serve as a bridge to ensure that the manufacturing base and consumer market are prepared for the complete elimination of tailpipe carbon emissions the following year. The enforcement of these environmental standards is backed by financial penalties. If a manufacturer exceeds its target, it must pay an excess emissions premium of 95 euros per gram per kilometer for each vehicle registered during that calendar year. For major corporations producing hundreds of thousands of vehicles, even a deviation of a few grams can escalate into penalties worth hundreds of millions of euros. This makes the math of compliance central to corporate strategy. To help manufacturers manage this transition, the European Union introduced a temporary compliance flexibility for 2025 through 2027. During this three-year period, compliance is evaluated based on a manufacturer's average performance over the entire span, rather than each single year. This multi-year average provides operational flexibility, allowing automakers to scale up supply chains and battery production without facing immediate penalties for single-year market fluctuations. While international standards reshape the global fleet, local governments are developing legal tools to manage the environmental footprint of development. Legislative records from Virginia in 2025 document a new statute enabling municipalities to establish local tree canopy funds. Under this law, developers who cannot meet tree preservation requirements on site can contribute financially to these funds, providing cities with resources to plant and maintain trees in neighborhoods with severe canopy deficits. These diverse challenges, from software recalls on highway vehicles to tree canopy preservation in local developments, show that public decisions are ultimately choices about how we allocate risks and benefits. To navigate these choices, we can apply a consistent civic risk test to any mobility or public space decision. This test asks several simple questions. Who benefits from this decision? And who pays for it? Who is responsible for maintaining the system? And who is exposed to its hazards? Who can choose to opt out? Whose voices are heard? And what evidence will trigger a revision when the outcomes fail to match promises? We can apply this civic risk test directly to a common municipal scenario, a road widening project designed to reduce traffic congestion. If a city decides to expand a major arterial road, the immediate benefit of faster travel times goes to drivers. Yet, the risks and long-term costs are redistributed to others. Pedestrians face wider, more dangerous crossings. Transit reliability suffers as buses struggle to navigate larger intersections. The surrounding neighborhood is exposed to higher emissions, increased stormwater runoff, worse localized heat, and the long-term burden of paying to maintain all that added asphalt. We can apply the same test to a park renovation, like the ongoing work at Chapel Hill Park. The design of pathways, seating, and play areas determines who can actually use the space. If the renovation prioritizes wide, unshaded concrete plazas, the park becomes unusable for many residents during the extreme heat of summer, shifting the burden onto families who lack private, air-conditioned spaces. We must weigh these new features against persistent maintenance backlogs, asking whether the city can afford to keep the park functional over time. If deferred maintenance piles up, it will eventually exclude those who rely on the space most. Finally, the civic risk test must be applied to the digital layer of transportation, specifically vehicle software deployment. When semi-automated driver assistance features are allowed on public roads, the benefits of convenience and safety are enjoyed by the driver and the manufacturer. The risks, however, are externalized to those outside the vehicle, such as pedestrians, cyclists, and occupants of other cars. They bear the harm if the driver's attention drifts or if the software fails to recognize a hazard. A responsible regulatory framework must measure these systems against strict standards for driver monitoring, clear warnings, rapid recall remedies, and an assessment of how foreseeable human misuse leads to public harm. This brings us back to the image of the racetrack pit lane, where we began. On the track, speed is a controlled spectacle, managed by impact-absorbing barriers, specialized survival cells, and an entire ecosystem designed to contain danger. But when we transition from the speedway to our everyday public realm, that illusion of total control falls away. The realities of our streets, trees, parks, and software are far less orderly and far more interconnected. The risks are not contained by concrete walls. They're absorbed by the people who live, walk, work, and commute in our shared spaces every day. If speed and technological spectacle remain our dominant civic symbols of progress, we must ask ourselves what we are sacrificing to maintain them. What would it mean for a city to measure success differently? We could value the safety of its most vulnerable residents, the equity of its shade canopy. We could prioritize transit access, corporate accountability, and the shared benefits of public spaces. This is the fundamental challenge of modern urban governance: choosing to design a world that protects and supports the many, rather than one that prioritizes the speed and convenience of a few. We have explored how our collective choices shape the environments we share, using Central Indiana as our lens into these national and global questions. At the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, we contrasted the highly engineered, contained safety of professional racing with the uncontained risks of car-dependent road networks. Outside the track, transit riders and pedestrians bear the heaviest burdens. We then turn to the physical landscape, examining how the urban forest functions as vital climate infrastructure. A massive tree equity gap in Indianapolis and the complex trade-offs in park renovations reveal that shade and cooling are matters of public health and shared infrastructure. Finally, the digital horizon reveals how software-driven recalls, international emission standards, and local legal tools represent a new frontier of risk allocation on public streets. By examining speed, shade, software, and public space, we gain a clearer understanding of the hidden architectures that govern our daily lives. Ultimately, the design of our cities is always a reflection of our shared values and our commitment to one another. Suggested further reading. If you want to keep pulling on the threads of mobility as policy, start with the Priority Climate Action Plan for Central Indiana, prepared through the Central Indiana Regional Development Authority with support from the EPA's Climate Pollution Reduction Grants. It's the clearest local big-picture explainer for how transportation emissions, corridor investments, and equity targets are meant to connect in practice, with strategies that treat highways, access, and vulnerable communities as one system rather than separate problems. In a tone that is informative and curious, with a clean and focused pace, to zoom in on what climate stress does to everyday movement, look next for Monroe County's Climate Resilience Plan from December 2024. It lays out major transportation routes as lifelines under heat, flood, and other hazards, useful for understanding what resilience means when the vehicles, roads, and timing of access are all part of the same exposure. For the human side of getting around, the Indianapolis Metropolitan Planning Organization's updated Coordinated Public Transit Human Services Transportation Plan for 2025 is a practical guide to who provides what, where mobility gaps persist, and how federal and state funds are supposed to land. It's the kind of document that won't feel like a manifesto, but it's packed with the details that show why transit can be both essential and constrained in a car-shaped region. On the shade and heat front, American Forest's tree equity score, especially the newer location insights approach, is a strong tool for learning how researchers translate canopy, heat, income, and other local data into a tree equity score you can actually use. Pair that with the Arbor Day Foundation's near Southside materials, which help make the canopy gap concrete. Then you can compare the tool's ideal targets with the real trade-offs cities face when they remove invasive trees and replant. Tesla's own safety recall report 23V838 for AutoSteer. This official safety recall report 23V838 was issued to document the identified concerns with Tesla's AutoSteer system, the corrective actions undertaken via an over-the-air software update, and the measures to reinforce ongoing driver responsibility, end quote. Summary of the issue. Tesla determined that under certain circumstances, the AutoSteer system might not sufficiently ensure rider engagement and awareness, potentially increasing the risk of misuse or failure to take over when needed. The system itself was functionally intact, but its monitoring and enforcement of driver attentiveness needed to be strengthened. Description of the remedy. Through an over-the-air update, Tesla modified the AutoSteer interface and behavior to include more prominent alerts and timely reminders prompting rider interaction. The system was updated to more aggressively detect and respond to driver inattentiveness. If the driver did not respond appropriately, the system would escalate warnings and could ultimately disengage, placing the vehicle's control back onto the driver. Reinforcement of driver responsibility. Throughout this document, Tesla emphasized that AutoSteer is a driver assist feature, not a replacement for driver attention and control. The updated interface includes clearer messages and stronger prompts to keep the driver engaged, reinforcing that the driver must remain attentive, monitor the surroundings, and be prepared to take control at all times. Impact on modern transportation liability. By addressing these issues through software, Tesla illustrates how the locus of transportation risk can shift from mechanical hardware failures to the realm of user interface, monitoring, and enforcement mechanisms. The recall underscores that, even with advanced driver assist systems, the human operator remains a critical component in ensuring safety. As such, the company has adapted its software approach to better align driver behavior with the system's capabilities, illustrating a shift in liability toward human software interaction and adherence. This report provides a window into the evolving landscape of automotive safety, where software updates can rapidly address potential risks, and where ongoing driver responsibility is reinforced by the interface and enforcement logic of these systems. And if you want the broader legal policy backdrop, the EU's CO2 standards package for cars and vans, Regulation EU 2023-851, along with the implementing decisions setting numerical targets, shows what tightening tailpipe rules look like in the real world of timelines, fleet averages, and compliance flexibility. Even though it's not U.S. law, it's a useful comparator for thinking about how governments try to allocate costs and accountability when just drive better isn't enough. This concludes the audiobook narration. Thank you for listening.